STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Well, hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason if my voice sounds just a tad tired. It's because I am a little bit tired. Been really running lately. In fact, just got in last night at about 7 o'clock from 7 p.m. at my house. Haven't traveled 22 hours from Norway. Was there for about a week. And just got back and had a short night, about 6 hours, then headed to the office today and a lot to do. I'm going to be on vacation in a couple of weeks, for a couple of weeks through June. And so we put a bunch of STR asks in the can so we can continue with that that broadcast coming down while I'm gone. Of course, this show will be covered by others while I'm away. But anyway, it's just been run. But I got to tell you, even though I never got used to the time change, I did a full day of work here at the office, did a show, and then headed for the airport, then went overnight, landed in Oslo, well, actually in Stockholm, and then switched over to Oslo, Norway. Got there about 3:30 in the afternoon and then had an event that night and just was running ever since. A couple of days in Oslo and then about 4 days or 3 days in Stavanger. That's the way I've learned to kind of pronounce it, but I'm not saying it quite right. It's spelled like Stavanger or Stavanger, which is the way I pronounced it before, but I never quite could get the right Norwegian pronunciation to it. And by the way, I pause there because it's really easy to mix up Norway and Sweden in Norwegian and Swedish and all of that. And I learned that one of the worst things, no, the worst thing that you can call a Norwegian is a Swede. All right. And maybe the Swedes return the favor. I don't know. But it's, I made the mistake about 24 times, and but they were very, very forgiving of this yank, and I had a wonderful, wonderful time with the men. There were nearly 48 men at a retreat, and we were up in the fjords and the mountains, and it was gorgeous. And I got to meet a lot of new friends, and I think make some new friends, and actually, I should say meet old friends that I never knew before, which is the case when you have a radio show that, you know, can be picked up anywhere in the world. I never know, and who'd have thunk that we'd have regular listeners in Norway? Well, I know we had some. That's how we got this opportunity. But it's amazing to me when I go someplace, and here, even a place like Norway, where there are people who are regular listeners and found out about the event because they heard about it on the show, and so then they went. There were 4 out of 48. That's nearly 10%. 4 out of 48 that were regular listeners to the show that were at the event. One of them found out about the event because he's an American who's working there, and it's this big oil industry there, and so you have a lot of expatriates from all different countries that are living there, working in the oil industry, and they have big tunnels that go under the fjords. They tunnel all the way under the fjords, and he is down underneath the ocean listening to podcasts. Actually, I had a whole bunch of, you don't get any reception there because you're under the ocean, right? And he's flipping through his podcast, not sure what to listen to next. I don't know. Somebody else must have loaded him on. Maybe he had somebody else's iPod or something. I don't know. But he just saw, hey, there's Stand to Reason. I'll try it out. And loved it. Began listening to it. And then I mentioned that I was coming to Norway, to his town. And there he was at the retreat. So it was good to meet him and some others that sitting right in the front row, three others, taking notes assiduously. It was great to see them and to meet them. and to be a direct encouragement to them. Which reminds me, now that I've mentioned it, when I am in Wisconsin, in the Woodruff-Minocqua area there, dead central, far north Wisconsin, I will be teaching June 19th at the EV Free Church there in Woodruff. You can find the details on our website, str.org/training/events. So I will be there Sunday morning for two services. I'll be teaching on naturalism bumping into reality, which is my basic talk against atheism now. And I will also be talking that evening, as I generally do, an open session Q&A. And that's always very well attended here in this small town in northern Wisconsin. Love to do that. Been doing it for many, many years, and I want to invite you, if you're within striking distance, you're welcome to come out for the event in the morning, the one in the evening, or both. And some people have traveled. I think last year somebody came up from Madison, which is about a five-hour drive, and just spent the night and stayed the day, and that was great to have them. So I'm letting you know that. Also, coming up the first week of July, well, first weekend of July, I will be getting back from Wisconsin, and I'll be back for like 3 days, and then my wife and I are climbing on a jet on Thursday, and we're going to the UK. And in London, the Christian Heritage London Day Conference will be taking place, and that will be Saturday, the 2nd of July. And, St. Botolph Without Aldersgate, City of London. That's the location. St. Botolph-Without-Aldersgate. Those of you who... Yeah, exactly what I was going to say. You live there, and you know what it is. That's where I'll be. And I've worked once before at the Christian Heritage Group out of Cambridge. Now they're relocated into London. And these are the crowd that gives tours of the city and explaining the Christian heritage of the place, whether it be Cambridge. And I was there 2 years with them for that in Cambridge, and now they've asked me back to do this in London. So I'm looking forward not only to doing the presentation that day, which will be on tactics, but I'm looking forward to spending time on the tour and then enjoying London and surrounds during my time there. I think I'm also, on Sunday, I am going to be at Leatherhead, and I'll be teaching there. That's in a community south of London. Disciples Church, right, Disciples Church. And I was there 2 years ago, I believe, as well, and they've invited me back. So I've got events that weekend, Saturday the 2nd and Sunday the 3rd. If you're in the area, again, I encourage you to check out our website at str.org/training/events, which means if you go to the website, then you look at training, you drop down, hit that, hit events, and there our whole schedule will come up, Brett, Allen's, Tim's, and mine, and that will all be there. So I told the story, by the way, when I was in Norway, and it's always, if you can find a way as a speaker to say something fun and genuine without trying to tell a joke when you first start out, that's always a good way to go, because it kind of gets things rolling. It gets people on your side if they enjoy the comment or story, and then it's easier to move right into your material. And as it turned out in this case, I could tell my audience, I did in a couple of locations, and this is a true story. Though I told them, this is my first time in Norway, and I'm glad to be here. It's kind of unique for me, but I have to tell you, I'm a little bit embarrassed, or I should tell you an embarrassing story. My buddies and I, Americans, are much worse in their geography than Europeans, even with regards to American geography. You know, Europeans just seem to know more. That's been my general experience over there, and I mentioned that to them. But a bunch of us had gotten together, this is many, many years ago, when I was at Hope Chapel, and we were chatting. I was on staff there in South Bay, California, Los Angeles area, Hermosa Beach, and we were all chatting away, something about Norwegians. I don't know how it came up. And then one person asked, where are Norwegians from? And we all looked stupidly at each other, like we couldn't figure it out. And then finally somebody said, Norwegia? And that kind of stuck. And so I was able to tell my audiences, so happy to finally visit Norwegia. They were fine with that as long as they didn't call it Sweden. That was it. Now, let's see. What do I want to do with this? I want to tell you something about our discussion we just had at staff today. And because there are things that happen at our staff meetings where we're knocking things around. And I've mentioned this kind of thing before. But I kind of want to share this with you as a guide or a tool or an encouragement or as a role model or something like that. I kind of wish, in a certain sense, that our meetings on a topic like we were discussing today could be broadcast. Now, I have a little hesitation there because sometimes it gets a little bit crazy, a little bit goofy, and not suitable for public consumption. You know, but we are deadly serious on the topics that we're talking about. And today we were talking about the topic of hell. Some of you might know that there is a surge of popularity regarding some, let's say, unorthodox views about hell. When I say unorthodox, I mean that they aren't the views that have been held by the church for the last 2,000 years, which to me is a mark against it. And I'm not just doing an argumentum ad populum, well, most people believe, and we got all these people on our side kind of thing, because the multitudes could be wrong, and often are. I'm really thinking of it in a different sense, in the sense that we have the church that is the body of Christ, and so there, and the Holy Spirit is in us, you know, helping us, working on theological matters. And so there is a kind of informal test to doctrine and theology called Catholicity, small c, and it's the idea that that in general the church has gotten it right for 2,000 years, and even though there are particulars that we have differed on, there is a core of things that are the most important things that we've agreed on, and this is what makes Christianity Christianity. And with this in mind, it seems hard for me to believe that the Holy Spirit has allowed the entire church for almost its entire existence to get an entire doctrine wrong on something that really mattered, okay? And that's the issue of hell. And the thing that, well, there are variations of this, but basically I could say the thing in question here, or the thing that's being challenged, is whether there is a hell at all. And in the last couple of years, there's been popular books written that seem to lean towards a universalism, the idea that people don't go to heaven and hell. Ultimately, it all works out. God wins in the end. And the way he wins is he gets everybody. And everybody ends up in heaven. However circuitous route they might take to get there, ultimately, everybody's in heaven. That's called universalism. And so there is a denial of eternal hell in that regard. There are others who say, you know, hell is just a completely unjust idea, and what ends up happening is the punishment that we get for our sins is kind of like capital punishment. You know, we just get executed. We're not in the pen for many, many, many years, like forever and ever. But rather we have capital punishment and are just wiped out. Now, this traditionally has been called annihilationism, but apparently the folks who believe that now don't like that word. I don't know why. I don't even see what's wrong with it. It doesn't even sound to me like pejorative in its, you know, in its characterization. You just get annihilated. That's the view. But maybe because Jehovah's Witnesses believe in what has been called annihilationism, then people who hold the same view as the Jehovah's Witnesses, though they identify themselves as Christians, and maybe are, I'm not making any judgment on that right now, they don't want to be associated with Jehovah's Witnesses, so they come up with a new term, which I think is conditional immortality or something, conditional mortality, what is it? It's conditional. I thought it was conditional immortality, that some are immortal, based on the condition that they believe in Jesus. And if they don't believe in Jesus, they just go out of existence. And this is the sense, they say, of what is being referred to in scriptures as destruction, and these will go away to eternal destruction. Okay, now I'm not going to argue the theology right now. save that for another time. I will say this, that I think destruction simply means ruination, not vanishment. And when you destroy a table with a sledgehammer, it doesn't vanish. It just is ruined for its original purpose. And I think that's what the writers have in mind. And that is a sticking point. It's a huge issue in this debate. What I want you to be aware of is how we work on the problem. Okay, and Tim actually was leading the action because he's been doing the bulk of the research. I've been busy with my own book and with a lot of traveling and stuff. And so Tim, one of our young guns, our youngest gun, so to speak, our newest player on the team from Toronto, he's been doing a lot of the research. And Tim is very, very good at this kind of thing, just like everybody else, thorough, fair. And so he was kind of like leading the conversation, letting us know what he had discovered, okay? But I want you to know the way that we went about doing this. And if you think about it, in circles that you've been associated with as Christians, you know, when unusual views, secular views, or fringe Christian views are discussed, there's a way that these things are handled, I guess, you know, and a lot of times there's ridicule or dismissal or maybe less than careful assessment of these kinds of things. And this is not a good habit for us as Christians to get into. And so I want to tell you, here's how we went through this. There were like three main emphases or three things that were characteristic of this discussion. And you need to know, by the way, it isn't like I sat down and said, here are the ground rules. This is just the way it all went, because this is the way we approach these issues, okay? The first thing we were trying to do, and Tim was excellent here, not only presenting the ideas, but then correcting others when necessary. And that is trying to be completely accurate and fair with the opposition. Trying to be completely accurate and fair with the opposition. That is, we do not want to mischaracterize another view. We want to make sure we get their views right. It's not only bad thinking if you get it wrong, it's bad manners. Okay, it is an informal fallacy called straw man, where you mischaracterize somebody else's view, and then the mischaracterization is easy to knock down, kind of like a straw man is easy to knock down. And so consequently, you can appear to be refuting a view when you're actually refuting a view the person does not hold, okay? We don't want to do that. We want to be completely accurate and fair with the characterization. We want to, and that also shows respect for the person who holds the view. You don't distort their view. This happens a lot of times to us. We don't like it, do we? And so we want to be careful not to do it with others. If we're going to present a view that we're going to critique, we're going to work hard at presenting that view accurately. Okay, that's the first thing they were trying to do. The second thing, I guess there are four things here now. The second thing we are trying to do is let's get a sense of how the field lays out for us. That is, if there are those in opposition to the classical view, which is that hell is eternal separation from God, that is constant conscious torment, and it's forever and ever. That's what eternal means. There's no ending. The clock doesn't run out. The clock doesn't even start to tick. If there are those that disagree with that view, then what are the varieties of disagreements? And it turns out that there are three main schools of thought or ways that the people who disagree with the classical view differ among themselves. Well, we want to be fair and distinguish these, and they also help us to be able to answer the challenge. Because if we're going to go in there and answer, we don't want to do a shotgun approach and just throw a bunch of stuff out there. No, we want to carefully say, well, some people hold this, and some people hold this, and some people hold this in opposition to the classical view. So that's the second thing. Well, how does this play out? What are the distinctions between the views? And many times, there's only one opposing view. It's uniform. All that oppose the classical view have a single voice in their opposition, in the content of their views in opposition of the classical view. Okay, so you got to know that. Here's the third thing that we did. We wanted to try to assemble, and this is obvious. Assemble counter arguments to their main points. Okay, so they believe there is no eternal hell for this reason and this reason and this reason and this reason. Now maybe there's three or four or five of them, and some of them are scriptural arguments, because the Bible says thus and so about this word, and this word means something different than everybody thought it meant. Or they might argue, well, that's what we think God does, but doesn't that strike you as unreasonable, unfair, unjust, or something like that? That's another type of objection. And if that's the objection offered to us, then what will we say in response, given the biblical characterization? So we're going to be looking at the texts ourselves and say, you know what, this doesn't really work. Their response doesn't work in light of the text, because the text says thus and so. So we're kind of building counter-arguments as we're talking back and forth for these different points. And sometimes we'll say, you know, this is a real strong point for them. That is, it's hard to come up with a counter to this particular one. However, this point over here, this is a very weak point, and we have this biblical point that seems, among all the rest of the things we might be able to say, decisive. That is, there's no way they can get around this one, and in fact, some on their side have said that. They've said, this one we really have a hard time dealing with. So it's good to know where your strengths and your weaknesses are in response to another issue, and to know where their strengths and weaknesses are as well. And so what we're doing is we're trying to deal with this issue, an opposing issue, and deal with it fairly. And we want to be completely accurate and fair with the opposition. That's our first. There's a lot of the discussion. What do they actually believe? And then we're looking at how the opposition lays out in terms of categories, so we can organize the enterprise a little bit. Then we want to think about the main points and figure counterarguments, and which ones of their points are stronger and which are weaker, and which ones of ours are stronger and weaker, and is there a point, an argument, scriptural or otherwise, that seems to be decisive? Now, they hold their view because they think that some of their arguments, at least, are decisive. And we hold our view because we think just the opposite. Some of our arguments are decisive and theirs aren't. There's one more thing that we've done here. This is the fourth thing. And then I'll take a break and take a call. Is that we were working really hard not just to come up with the counter-arguments to their main points, but trying to anticipate counter-arguments to our counter-arguments. And I have talked about this before. I know I've talked about it on the air, and I encourage it when I'm doing training with people. Always try to figure out, if you're going to have a point of view, what might the other side say regarding your view? How would they object? What might the weak points of your view be, whether your view is the view proper or whether it's a counter-argument to a view that you are trying to correct? And that's what we are facing in this case. And so we'd lay this thing out. This is our idea. Well, this is a point that they've offered, but here's the problem with it. Somebody would toss that in. And then somebody would jump in and say, wait a minute. Here's what they're going to say to that. They're going to say this, this, and this. And so now we're trying to deal with the counters to the counters kind of thing. And that's the way to work through issues if you want to deal with issues in a thorough fashion. Now, we have to do that because you're counting on us to do this. This is part of what we do for a living, so to speak. This is our role in your life. But we are doing it this way because it's the sound way to do it. That is, we would like, we're doing it, hopefully, the right way. We have to do it that way because, you know, you're counting on us, but it's the same way you ought to do it too. Maybe not as thoroughly, but the idea is exactly the same. The process that you'll go through is the same. First, be completely accurate and fair with the opposition. Then, if the points of view are complex, how do you organize that so you can make sense of the parts? Third, what are the counterarguments you might give to their views? And then fourth, anticipating the counters to your counterarguments and how you might respond to them. It's the best way, I think, to go about it. Anyway, that's a little teaching you how to think, not just teaching you what to think. All right, I'm Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, back with your calls in a moment.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's mentoring letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free. So download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
Greg Kokel back at you here at Stand to Reason. Two things not to forget, both of them in August. SDR's Cruise Conference to Alaska, August 6th through 13th. We're all looking forward to that tremendously. My family's, this will be the third time to Alaska, the fifth Stand to Reason cruise. And it's great because I get to bring my family and kids with me. Plus, I get to participate in this great cruise conference. In this case, J. Warner Wallace from Cold Case Christianity is going to be on board with us. John Stone Street from the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview will be there. He'll have his own kids. I'll have my kids. J. Warner will be there with his wife. And we'll be teaching and training and building you up and teaching you how to think more effectively as Christians, and all in the atmosphere of a great cruise on the Inside Passage there in Alaska. Our ports, Juneau, Alaska, Sitka, Ketchikan. We'll also be stopping in Victoria, BC, Canada. You'll need a passport for that. So please join us. And the following, well, a little more than a week later, on the 18th through the 20th, will be our annual Cross-Examine Instructors Academy. Now, it's not our annual. It is Frank Turek's CIA. He's been doing this for a number of years, and Brett Kunkel and I have participated along with others virtually every year. I think this is eighth or ninth year that we've been doing this, but it's usually in Charlotte. And this year, it's going to be the Southern California, Costa Mesa. You go to crossexamine.org for all the information there. And the our point here is to train Christians to be better communicators of apologetics. And so Frank has got this great material from his book with Norm Geisler, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And he delivers that material to you in the form of slides and outlines and all this other stuff. Then the idea is that you can take portions of this and develop your own talks, and then we jury the talks. You get a 15-minute talk. You give it a couple of times. We give you feedback. We critique you, and we try to help you to be a better communicator. So that's all going on the 18th through the 20th. Of course, I'll be there, and Brett and Frank and a number of others. I don't have the lowdown right here, but you can get it at crossexamined.org. All the information there. That's crossexamined, past tense with a D, .org. And I hope you join us for that, August 18th through 20th. And by the way, you need to move on that quickly if you're thinking about it, because I think there's a closure date on that. And even in our case, we don't have a closure date, but they start giving away for the cruise, berths that have been set aside for us, you know, and then if we haven't taken them yet, you know, they start opening them up to other passengers. So if you've been thinking about either of those things, we encourage you to make your call and take care of that quickly. You know, I didn't tell you about where to contact us for the cruise. You can go to inspirationcruises.com/STR or simply contact them at 800-247-1899. All righty. Let's go to a first caller here. It's Dave in Pennsylvania. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Greg. How are you tonight?
I'm doing okay. I got a little bit of scratchy throat, and, you know, I just got back from Norway, and maybe that's part of it, all that time change and everything. But what was a little bit weird is even in here at the end of May, it never got completely dark, you know, and it was light, like, all night long. And so you're chatting away with people, you think it's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's 10:30 at night, you know. It's a little bit disconcerting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well, Greg,
I'm a
long-time listener and a first-time caller here tonight.
Okay, glad to have you.
And, well, thank you. I'm also a monthly supporter, and I just want to say that I want to encourage anybody else that benefits from STR to consider helping you guys out, making a monthly donation. I think you guys do a wonderful job.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. And thanks for your support, Dave.
You bet. Well, Greg, I'm sort of in an awkward position tonight. I'm sort of playing the devil's advocate.
All right.
I wanted to talk to you about one of your arguments on theistic evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the most part, you and I agree on a lot here. I'm very skeptical of theistic evolution.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, lack of transitional forms is a very powerful problem that mm-hmm. they have, a good argument you can make against them. I think there are a number of good arguments you can make. So I want to make it clear, I'm not a theistic evolutionist.
Sure.
But I do want to take issue with the one argument that I've heard you and Tim Barnett offer.
Okay.
So
can I jump in for a second just to underscore a point that what you've just offered kind of implicitly is that theistic evolution as a point of view presumes that the Darwinian model itself is viable. And then there's an attempt to marry Christian theism with the viable model of Darwinian evolution, and that's why it's called theistic evolution. And what you've offered are some concerns about the viability of the Darwinian model itself. So apart from the theistic piece of the discussion, if Darwinian evolution as characteristically construed itself is not viable as a view, if there are serious problems with it that call it into question, well, then there's no reason to marry theism to what might be a kind of like the sinking ship of the Titanic,
of
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
of evolution, right. So I just wanted to make that side point. But you want to zero in on something in particular.
Yeah, a different argument that you had that I've heard you offer on your ABC course, and Tim Barnett also recently offered in one of his podcasts.
Huh?
And I don't want to misrepresent you, so please correct me if I misrepresent your point of view here.
Mm-hmm.
But that evolution, by definition, is unguided, and therefore it is self-contradictory to talk about God guiding an unguided process of theistic evolution.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. I think there is some debate among people about the unguided part of it, and I mm-hmm. know that... Say, Bill Craig, for example, you know, he takes exception with this aspect of it, you know. He doesn't think it has to be, now I'm trying to remember specifically how he puts it, okay? He draws from another evolutionist thinking that we may be misrepresenting their view to claim that it's completely unguided, okay? And my response to that is just about every single proponent of the Darwinian model that you read mm-hmm. is going to make it clear that to paraphrase one of its major proponents, it's an unguided process that did not have us in mind.
Right, that's Darwinian evolution.
Yes, and if you start saying, well, there was a God-guided evolution, they're going to say, and they do say, you don't understand evolution. Evolution
don't understand
has...
Darwinian evolution.
Pardon me?
We don't understand Darwinian evolution.
And I, maybe this is going to be part of our discussion, but that's mm-hmm. the thing that's involved here. There are a couple of different ways of defining evolution, But the one that I deal with is the neo-Darwinian neo-Darwinian evolution, the neo-Darwinian synthesis, and that is the idea that genetic mutations plus natural selection is what drives the so-called creative process. This is the famous blind watchmaker of Richard Dawkins.
Sure.
Yeah. So that when I say that theistic evolution is a contradiction in terms, I am using the term evolution the way the standard evolutionary proponents use the word.
And I think therein lies the problem.
Well,
if I could.
No, of course you can. I'm not sure it's a problem. You know, I'm trying to refute one view or one concept, and if somebody changes their view or has a different definition, then that is not the view that I'm taking exception with.
Right.
So,
let me start with an analogy that I think will make it really clear.
Okay.
Fruit trees, Greg. Are fruit trees organic?
Are fruit trees organic?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that depends what you mean by organic. Why don't you do this instead
of
asking?
You plant them in the ground and you give them water and sunlight and they grow.
Well, they're biological things. I'm not sure what you mean by organic, but instead of asking me the questions, why don't you just make your case?
Okay, well, I was going to ask you about family trees and whether they're organic, and obviously they're not. So even though it's essential to all fruit trees that they be organic, family trees are, of course, not organic, and that's not a contradiction.
What do you mean? Family trees like
as in a graph that represents your family
ancestry. Yes, because the word tree is used in a totally different way.
Correct. Fruit and family are adjectives that modify the noun tree.
Right, but the concept of tree is used differently. Yes, right. Okay, I got it.
And in the same way, Darwinian and theistic are adjectives that must be allowed to modify the word evolution.
That's
so
right.
I'd like to know how you are allowing the word theistic to modify evolution.
Okay, well, that's a fair point.
We're not talking about Darwinian evolution. We're talking about theistic evolution, which is different.
Well, that is a point of discussion here, I think, Dave, because... Look, when I the BioLogos crowd, for example, Francis Collins, these are the quintessential kind of theistic evolutionists that's out there now, and there are different strains of theistic evolutionists, but the kinds that I have written against and taken exception with, and this is where I talk about the contradiction in terms. I am speaking of those who, by and large, accept the Darwinian model as completely adequate on its own. In other words, they believe that it is that the process itself is unguided, that there is no kind of divine intervention at stages of the genetic mutation or the natural selection. This is all just flowing out there, you see.
Okay.
So what they do is they buy the Darwinian model. They agree with the entire Darwinian model, and then they want to attach God to it. And my question is, if they're going to do this, and that, so I'm critiquing a particular species of theistic evolution in this regard. And so if they want to try to attach God to that kind of evolution and call it theistic evolution, then it seems like they're saying that God guided an unguided process, since that kind of evolution is by definition unguided. And that would be a contradiction of terms.
I'm confused now. Are you making the claim that theistic evolutionists do claim that God is guiding it, or do not claim that God is guiding it?
No.
Well, then your argument is a straw man.
Mine isn't a straw man.
They're not claiming that God is guiding an unguided process. You just told me they don't claim God is guiding it at all.
No, they think the process is unguided, but God is somehow responsible for it. And so they are buying, this is the problem here, because my question to them is, okay, if you think that God somehow used evolution, and this is the way it's characteristically put, that the Darwinian model is the right model, and all the Darwinian processes that are identified are legitimate, but somehow God used that, then what that person is going to have to do is he's going to have to specify what it is that God did. Now, if God intervenes at different stages and causes, say, a mutation, or causes the environmental circumstances directly that select for a particular mutation, well, then that's not the evolution that we're talking about. That's a species of intelligent design. And they don't hold that anyway. They don't think that God has done that. So then my question is, you tell me, not you, Dave, but you, the theistic evolutionists, tell me what you think God actually did. And the most right. common way to characterize it is that God kind of set everything up in the beginning in such a way that it kind of all the dominoes fell in a very particular fashion.
Like a trickshot artist in pool.
I didn't understand that.
One time and all the balls go in.
Well, this is called fully gifted creation, and this is another way of characterizing it. But there are problems with that view as well, and I've actually written an extensive article about this. So I do think it still comes down to defending an essentially unguided process with a theistic label which suggests guidance. And unless somebody can show me how this process is guided by God in a way that's believable, well, then I think you've still got a contradiction. You've got a process that all the players in this species of theistic evolution that I'm describing is the Darwinian model that everyone who is not a Christian holds to. They are not taking exception with the standard secular model.
Right.
And the standard secularists say it is unguided. It is genetic mutations that happen serendipitously, and it is circumstances in the environment that are not controlled either that result in the evolution that we have of man. And what the theistic evolutionists want to say is, yep, that's true, but somehow God's responsible for it. And so it all works out the way he wants, and that's theistic evolution. Now, it still strikes me as a contradiction. And I don't think I've misrepresented their view.
Well, are you claiming that they say God is guiding it or not?
Well, there's the ambiguity. Because what I want them to be able to say is this process that everyone is saying is unguided, and at certain times they say is, but God is somehow teleologically responsible for it. I want to know, okay, spell that out. Because at face value, it is contradictory. And this is what I haven't heard yet. Exactly what does God do?
Yeah, I agree with you. There need to be a lot more details. I think I agree with most of what you said here. I just think that if they are claiming God's guiding theistic evolution, that's different than Darwinian evolution, and so it wouldn't necessarily be a contradiction.
But it isn't.
If they're not saying God's guiding it, then we shouldn't be making that argument that says that they are saying that.
But see, Dave, here's the problem. They are accepting in whole cloth the Darwinian model. And all of these folks acknowledge that are the secular crowd and this is the reason, part of the reason is they want to be in the mainstream of the secular crowd. This is the virtue of the view. Because if you don't hold what all the other scientists hold, then you are somehow outside of the mainstream, and nobody's going to believe your theological views if they disagree with this mainstream scientific view. So they accept the mainstream scientific view. Now, this is one reason that I've kind of offered this illustration. The illustration is, what if I were to tell you, you asked me, how do I boil water? I said, well, you take a beaker of water down to sea level, you crank up the Bunsen burner, and when it reaches 212 degrees, you add a leprechaun, and then the water boils.
Right.
And then you say, what if I didn't add the leprechaun? Would the water still boil? I say, yes. And so you say, well, I'm just going to leave the leprechaun out. And so you can see the parallel here, that the way it sets up for theistic evolution. They want to add the leprechaun, which is God, to a process that seems entirely adequate on its own to get the ends they have in mind. And they also affirm that. And that's where the trouble lies for them,
I think that's a good argument. I agree with that argument. If they say that God isn't doing anything, that's a good argument. You got the problem of where the new information from these species comes from and others.
They want to say that God's doing something, but they aren't willing to tell you what he does, because the thing that they affirm actually happens is the same thing that the atheists say is happening. That's the problem.
Yep.
So I don't know if that helps you at all, Dave.
I think what you offered tonight were good arguments. I just
you want to keep chewing
again,
on it.
Again, I don't agree with calling it self-contradictory theistic evolution, but
okay.
Well, anyhow.
Okay, you do what you like with it.
I think the arguments you offered were good.
Here, there is a piece that I wrote that a solid ground 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. I lose track of these things. It's called Drifting Towards Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Drifting Towards Darwin, in which I address this issue and the precise points that you and I have been talking about. So if you want to get a more kind of fleshed out version of this argument, I suggest you go and check that out. It should be on our website. All right?
Fair enough.
Hey, Dave, thank you for your call, and thank you for your challenge, and thank you for your support for Stand to Reason. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Appreciate
all
three.
Thank you for being gracious towards me, even though we disagree.
All right, buddy.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, all the best. Okay, time for a quick break, and then back with Stand to Reason.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5 by 11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our 2-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas, and we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
Greg Kokel here, giving you a piece of my mind, as I do regularly. Well, I can't say weekly now because I've been in and out a lot. This is the time of year where that happens. I travel sometimes overseas, May, June, July, and that just happened last week. It'll happen again in July, and then I got some time with my family the month of June, so I got others that will be replacing me. But I'm here a lot and glad to do so and to be an encouragement to you as a follower of Christ. And if you're not a follower of Christ, maybe just, as I like to say, to annoy you in a good way by putting a stone in your shoe. Last week, I made reference to an article that, it turns out, comes from the Huffington Post. And the title is Jesus, the First Transgender Man. I actually don't think I said anything about the article itself, but I made some kind of introductory, I talked about this issue a little bit. And I think the issue that I pointed out, what I'm concerned about, and I'm not going to go line for line with this article. It doesn't deserve that. But it's the kind of thing when something captures the culture's imagination. And this is an example of that. For a long time, we were just consumed with the same-sex marriage thing, and then SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States of America, made their decision last June that the Constitution guarantees same-sex marriage, and so that's now a fait accompli. It's over with. And now what's next on the agenda? And all of a sudden, the transgender issues hit us with a force. And in fact, I mean, my head is still spinning on this issue. I can't believe what has happened in the last year. 1 year ago today, this wasn't even on the radar. That doesn't mean the transgender issues were not being discussed, whatever. But I am talking about what has come to be known as the kind of bathroom wars. This idea that somebody's self-perception is their true identity. Now, this has been around for a while, but now this is being enforced by law. And this is the thing that is unbelievable, because I don't have enough time to go into this today, but there are laws being made now, judicial actions being made now that are for a small sliver of people, but it has ramifications for everyone, because there's a whole lot of people who are not part of that sliver of those people who could take advantage of these new legal actions and never be challenged. Now, maybe next time around, and it'll probably be weeks from now before I can get to this, but I can talk more detail about it. I just want to tell you that Tim Challies, Challies, did a blog today that deals with those issues. It's titled "The Transgender Conversation You Need to Have with Your Family." You got to read it. Just read it. It's not very long. But what happens when these kinds of things capture the imagination of our culture and they go nutty about it is that you always got somebody that's going to kind of climb onto the Christian bandwagon here. And it's going to say, you know, if you're really a good Christian, you ought to bake the cake for the same-sex marriage. You know, Jesus would bake the cake, so you should bake the cake. And they bring Jesus in there on behalf of this new thing. So this article is titled, it's in the Huffington Post, May 18th. It's called "Jesus, the First Transgender Man." And it starts out, "The current flap in conservative Christian circles about bathroom access is a bit baffling." Really? And it's they shout about God not making mistakes, as if God only works in binaries, and anything falling outside of black and white cannot be from him. Now, this is a straw man. This isn't our view. It isn't why we're upset, okay? We're upset because there's a security concern, and there is a privacy concern about the bathroom issues that apply to our children and ourselves. You know, University of Toronto, is it Toronto or, no, Calgary. I have the article here somewhere. University of Toronto, there you go, had gender neutral bathrooms. Like for 3 weeks, that was it. And there was so much voyeurism going on, guys going in there in a women's place, taking photographs, movies, they had to change their policy. No duh. Isn't this just obvious? And anyway, to kind of cut to the chase here, the basic gist of this article is that Eve was kind of transgender, since she was created, or actually cloned, kind of, from the rib of Adam. And then Jesus was kind of transgender, since he was also kind of cloned from Mary. That just summarized most of the article. And so this author is getting on Christian's case, because they're, especially the Christian literalists, the first worst offenders are the Christians who claim to take the Bible literally. If they took it literally, they'd see this insight that I have, that Mary, or rather that Eve was cloned and transgendered off of Adam, and Jesus was actually the first transgender man. That's the title of the article. This is silly. So if you really take the Bible seriously, literally, you wouldn't be all up in arms about guys going to girls' bathrooms, you crazy Christians. Listen, there's a statement here about states that do not support trans persons' right to choose the restroom that fits their identity, demand that bathroom usage be based on a person's biological sex, as if this is something bizarre. Let me tell you something. Men's and women's bathrooms were never meant to match a person's gender identity. It was meant to match their gender. That's why men's bathrooms have urinals. And the piece ends, "A quick look through the dictionary for prefix trans tells us it means across, beyond, through, and changing thoroughly, all of which are great terms for the person of Christ." I don't know where this person is getting her theological information. It's a woman here, Suzanne DeWitt Hall, but I'm just warning you, you're going to get more of this stuff, okay? And I hate having to deal with this, because this is not, I want to say it's not a significant issue. It is a significant issue. It has radical ramifications for our culture and for all of us that have nothing directly to do with the transgender issue. At least with homosexuality, a lot of people knew a homosexual person. I mean, there's a sense in which this is a broad-based issue that influenced a lot of people. This influences almost no one, statistically speaking, that is directly, the transgenderism is rare. But the consequence of these silly laws, or I should say actions that disallow the passing of laws, this is going to have consequence for many, many, many people. And I'm looking here now. I've got this recent statement from the Attorney General as they were announcing that the Obama administration is filing a lawsuit against North Carolina over its bathroom bill. Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, says this, quote, "This action, this is defense of them going after North Carolina and withholding funds and threatening because they want bathrooms to be for the sex, not the gender identity." Okay, you know about it. Quote, "This action is a great deal more, is about a great deal more than just bathrooms." Yes, she's right there. This is about the dignity and respect we accord our fellow citizens and the laws that we as a people and as a country have enacted to protect them. Indeed, to protect all of us. I agree entirely with everything. And then she says it's about the founding ideals that have led this country haltingly but inexorably in the direction, now listen, of fairness, inclusion, and equality for all Americans. Close quote. Of course, you know what she means by fairness, inclusion, and equality there, and I guarantee you this is not what the founders had in mind. They did have in mind dignity and respect. They did have in mind protection. And so the question that needs to be answered here with regards to the so-called bathroom bills are, do these bills now afford property, dignity, and respect for the vast majority of people who use those bathrooms? And indeed, do they protect them? That's the question. Because the fact is, the same laws that allow transgender persons to use the bathroom that they want allow anybody else to use that bathroom too, regardless of their identity. And this creates a threat for us, our children especially. Read Tim Challies today, Challies, his blog, May 31st. And that's it for the show. Thanks, friends. Enjoyed being with you today. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.